not with fire and emotion. A queenly decision, not her first or last. The voice that emerged from her throat seemed to come from a long way off, like Anise was a mere spectator, watching herself from afar. I will not surrender. I will not bow to the will of sellswords and mercenaries. I will not rest until those who seek to usurp my throne have been laid low like the pond scum they are. This is my kingdom. This is your kingdom. What say you? She'd expected a roar of approval, the shriek of swords from scabbards, the stomp of boots, something. What she got was silence. The quiet, however, was not idle. One by one, her diverse group of soldiers raised their fists, first over their heads, and then lower, settling over their hearts. Dietrich said, "We were with you before you spoke, my queen." 4. The Northern Kingdom, on the road to Castle Hill. Sir Christoph Metz. Sir Christoph Metz felt sick. I did this. This is my fault. It was just like with his little brother, Jordo, who died tragically after falling down a well when he was supposed to be watching him. Castle Hill had been taken on his watch. Lady Zelda might die because he'd failed to do his duty. But I helped save Darin. Terin Shiri might be dead if I hadn't acted. The Eastern invaders might have even been marching on Castle Hill at this very moment. All those soldiers, men he'd trained, men who'd been willing to lay down their lives to protect the castle he'd abandoned. The world began to spin, a kaleidoscope of white and green and yellow shards of light. Christoph's hands were on his head before he could stop them. Please, please, please. No, no, no. My fault. My fault. My fault. Can't save them. Can't save Jordo. Not anymore. Can't save any of them. Not one. And Lady Zelda is going to Christoph, a voice said from the side, jolting him from his inner argument, the mania that threatened to take hold. Slowly, slowly, the world stopped spinning. Christoph's head was throbbing where he'd pounded on his own skull. He stared at the woman who had spoken. Her name was Mona, though he would never call her that in public, where she was Private Shiri, and astride the white horse she might have been the most beautiful creature Christoph had ever laid eyes on. Her jet-black hair flowed behind her like streamers carried on the breeze. Her sharp, thin eyebrows were narrowed, a look of concern on her face. A strangely warm feeling started in his chest when he met her eyes, racing down his torso and all the way to his toes. The day must be growing warmer than I expected, Christoph thought. Other than in battle, she was the only person whose gaze he could meet without flinching. Still, he could only hold it for a moment, those green eyes penetrating him to the core, before looking away. A memory of a forbidden embrace rose in his mind, but he blinked it away. They hadn't spoken of that moment since it had happened, and Christoph didn't want to think about it now. He was her captain, and she his private. Anything else between them would have to wait until the war was over, lest they descend into chaos. "Private Shiri," Christoph said, his eyes settling somewhere on her shoulder. "Please refer to me as Captain, or Captain Metz." A shadow fell over her eyes. If anything, it only made her look more beautiful. "Stop thinking such thoughts," Christoph chided himself. "Yes, Captain Metz," she said, not trying to hide the dryness in her tone. For once, Christoph knew he was being mocked, even if he didn't understand why. "Did you have a question?" he asked. She shook her head. "I was going to ask if you were all right, but now I see that wouldn't be appropriate." He cocked his head to the side. "Why would you ask that?" "Because your face was twitching as you rode, and you were muttering under your breath. You started hitting yourself and making a strange sound. I was concerned for your well-being." Christoph felt his cheeks flush. His mother used to call them fits, when everything felt like it was spiraling out of control and he needed to claw his way out of his body, else be consumed by a mad world with no logic, no order. Over time, he'd learned to control them, to run away from whatever situation was causing his anxiety. In fact, This was the first true fit he'd had in many years. "It's hard to run from your own thoughts," he mused. He noticed Mona, no, Private Sheary, still looking at him, her brow furrowed. What had she said? Yes, that she was concerned for his well-being. Again, that warmth. He breathed out deeply, willing his feelings back to a place where he could control them, like a wild mustang confined to a corral. "Thank you, but I am fine," he said, willing it to be true. "I should introduce you to my fellow captain, Taryn Sheary." "Captain Sheary!" As he rode away from her, he felt like a hollow shell, everything vital scooped out from within. 5. The Northern Kingdom, on the road to Castle Hill. Taryn Sheary. After a rushed introduction, Sir Christoph Metz rode off as if he was being chased by a pack of hungry wolves. It didn't surprise Taryn in the least. Since he'd known the man, he was always a bit different than other knights he'd known.
"Did Sir Metz say your last name was Sheary?" Taryn asked, focusing on the woman on the horse beside him.
Anise was off somewhere, encouraging her soldiers, riding the line, as she called it. "Mona Sheary," she said. "I mean, Private Sheary." She wasn't looking at him, her gaze tracking Sir Metz as he rode away.
"Don't let him offend you,"
Taryn started to say, but stopped when she turned to meet his stare. Though he'd seen her around, after all, she'd apparently helped treat his wounds when he was grievously injured, never in such bright light in close proximity. It was like a memory brought to life. A woman moving about a small one-room house, bustling in and out with armfuls of firewood. Split herself, of course. She was a woman of the north, after all. Stoking the flames, stirring the stewpot, singing a soft melody under her breath. Whirling when she caught him watching, grabbing him under the arms, picking him up, spinning, spinning, until he was dizzy and laughing and tumbling to the floor in a heap. And her name. Her name.
"No," Taryn thought. "Not her. My mother. My mother's name was Mona."
"Sir, I mean Captain Sheary?" The woman was looking at him quizzically with that familiar face, so like his mother's that he couldn't stop staring at it.
"We share a last name,"
Taryn said, his voice low, almost reverent. She smiled the purest smile, one he'd only seen on one other person in his life, so long ago. "So it seems," she said. "It's not an uncommon name in the North, but still, the North is growing smaller." Even her voice was familiar.
"Frozen hell. Can it be? Truly?" "Where are you from?"
he asked casually, as if making light conversation. "Blackstone. And you?" Taryn had participated in several tourneys at Castle Hill over the years. At one such tournament, he'd gathered his nerves in a bundle and sought out his parents' old home. His old home. Set within the castle walls, where his father had worked as the king's horsemaster, breeding and training his royal stallions. The house was gone, razed to the ground, replaced by more stables. His parents were gone too. He'd been so bold as to inquire about them, as if they were old friends of his family. Evidently they'd left many years earlier, the same time he'd run away from home, a scared and changing boy, swiftly becoming a man, at least in body, if not mind. His absence had driven them away, like a ghost haunting their steps. No one had known where they'd gone, but now he suspected this girl had brought him the answer.
"Blackstone," he said.
"Where in Blackstone?" she asked.
"No,"
he said, shaking his head.
"I mean, I'm from Castle Hill."
"Oh, my mother spoke of Castle Hill often. She had a sister there, though I never met my aunt nor uncle. The only connection I have to them is my name."
"Mona,"
whispered, like a forbidden word spoken only in the shadows in the dark of night. "Was that so hard? Captain Metz seems to think speaking my name will cause frozen hell to open up and receive him." She laughed lightly, oblivious to Terran's inner turmoil. Terran breathed in. Out.
"My mother's name was Mona," he said.
"Truly?" That smile, like a mirror into a long-forgotten past. No, not forgotten, not really. Just hidden, like an ugly table covered by a cloth.
"Yes. She was beautiful. Like you."
Something changed in the woman's expression. A flicker of recognition. A spark of truth. "Oh!" she exclaimed. What are you saying?" Terran's eyes met hers, which were emerald green, the exact shade his mother's eyes had borne. If she was younger, she might have been his sister. Instead, there was only one other possibility.
"You bear more than my mother's name. You have her nose, her expressions, and her eyes. Mona Shiri, I believe we might be cousins."
Terran had feared her reaction might be negative. Who would want to be related to a strange-looking giant of a man known for brutality in battle? What he got instead was something different entirely. Her face lit up like she'd won a prize at a festival, and she clapped her hands with childlike glee. "I'm cousins with the Armored Knight," she said with delight. "I used to watch you compete in the tournaments. You are Ma and Da's favorite." Her voice fell on the last part, her gaze slipping to the ground.
"I'm sorry," Terran said,
wondering whether his own parents were alive somewhere, wondering if they were in Blackstone. If so, he wondered whether they ever thought of him. Mona looked up, her eyes wet. "It's been 3 years," she said. "I thought it would get easier."
"It does. It will."
Not lies, but not exactly the truth either. The loss of ones you loved was always there, a constant companion, even when time smoothed out the ragged edges, sopped up the hurt. "Thank you. It was an accident. A runaway horse. They were... trampled." She paused, seeming to collect herself. "At least they passed on together, so they didn't have to hurt the way I have." It was at that moment that Anise rode up on a magnificent white stallion, his head bobbing with undisguised bravado. "The soldiers are in good enough spirits," she said. Her eyes flicked between Terran's and Mona's, her head cocking to the side. "Private Shiri, right? You helped Christoph tend to Terran when he was injured. I don't know that I ever formally thanked you." Mona blushed, bowing slightly. "It was my pleasure, Your Highness." Terran said,
"Anise, we've just discovered something. Mona is my cousin."
As Anise's eyebrows lifted, Terran felt something he hadn't experienced in a long time. The feeling of belonging, that sense of being and familiarity that only family could bring. "Well," Anise said, "this calls for a celebration." 6. The Northern Kingdom, approaching Castle Hill. Lisbeth Lorne. The souls of the sleeping knights, once a rainbow of swirling, ever-changing colours, were now a fiery red as they stood sentinel in the darkness of night. Thus far, they hadn't slept since leaving the hinterlands. Lisbeth had tried to rest, but somehow her life force felt connected to these ancient warriors, and sleep continued to elude her. Her concern was growing by the day. The knights were unspent energy, like a boulder teetering on a precipice, impatient to fight, to destroy the enemies of the north. Sometimes she heard their voices in the dark recesses of her mind, ripe with violence, centuries of purpose, once full of honour and light, now darkening around the edges, flames turning honour to ash. She feared what they would do once Castle Hill was reclaimed. "You control them. You can stop them." But could she? At first she would have said yes. After all, it was she who had freed them from their icy prison. Day by day, however, she felt their leashes growing longer, fraying to naught but ragged threads.
"You cannot hide your fear from us," they said now,
their souls pulsing as one, red darkening to crimson, darkening to black.
But your fear is misplaced.
You will not destroy this continent? She asked, hoping against hope for a simple answer.
We will do what is necessary for the North. You should never fear for the North, only for its enemies.
She looked away, unable to watch that restless energy any longer. That was exactly why she was worried, for she wasn't convinced these reborn knights could discern friend from foe, their wills blinded by the wars of the past, by the need to conquer.
If you will not obey me, you must obey the Queen. She is the leader of the North.
We will, they said, so long as she doesn't stray from the path.
Dread curled through her. This was the first time they'd so openly admitted such a thing. Tentatively, she reached out to touch their souls, one at a time, and then all at once. She felt the blue eye on her forehead burst to life, squeezing, grappling. Agony spiked through her head, radiating through her body, and she fell to her knees. Her head clutched in her hands, her blue eye fading, flashes of red pulsing behind her eyelids. The pain, was this what the Ghazi felt when she touched their souls? Bile rose in her throat, her body convulsing. She saw the past, she saw the present, and worst of all, she saw the future. Broken bodies, carrion for massive birds with hooked beaks and blade-like talons. Fallen cities, smoke rising like wispy grey clouds. Cries of mourning, rending the silence like an executioner's scythe through flesh. Truth, future, pain. The fall of all things. And that one word, a drumbeat resonating across it all. Horde.
Lisbeth?
The pain faded. The images vanished. The sounds slipped away. Lisbeth opened her eyes to find a familiar soul standing before her, faded blue and rough around the edges. Sir Dietrich. She looked left and right, but the sleeping knights were not there, having moved away, off to release their pent-up energy elsewhere.
"Are you hurt?" Sir Dietrich asked.
"Yes."
"No."
"Your head, you were clutching it. Does it ache?"
"Yes." "No."
"Still, you should rest. We will reach Castle Hill tomorrow."
"So soon?"
A shudder ran through her, though the night was the warmest yet.
"I cannot sleep."
The knight chuckled.
"I know the feeling. Sleep has been my enemy for many years. May I keep you company, at least?"
Ever since she left Crone's warm house made of ice, the only company she'd had was fear.
"Yes, please."
Dietrich sat next to her, waves of blue and white crisscrossing along his soul. She curled her legs beneath her, letting her blue dress drift across her legs. Dietrich said,
"This is a strange world."
She laughed, mostly because it summed up her entire experience in human form so accurately. It felt good to laugh. Almost hopeful.
"Why? Because a blind girl with an all-seeing eye summoned ancient knights from an ice castle? Or because when you wield your sword, it moves faster than the eye can track?"
After seeing his soul in battle at Darin, Lisbeth had inquired about the mysterious Sir Dietrich. She'd been surprised to find that he, too, bore a mark of power. Something about that fact made her feel more at ease with him than anyone else, save perhaps Queen Anise. He chuckled again, and she found herself quite enjoying the deep rumble and the fact that she had caused it.
"I was thinking more about how I just met a fellow with 11 toes, he said.
The laugh that slipped from her throat included an unexpected snort, and she covered her mouth with a hand.
"Truly? Or was that a jeep?"
"If I told you, it would ruin the surprise of you possibly meeting this fellow one day. Now, each time you meet a man, you will secretly hope he'll take his shoes off."
"Do you ever speak seriously?" she asked,
though his levity was like a breath of fresh air in the stale cave of darkness she seemed to reside in.
"Not if I can help it," he said. "But I will if you'd like."
There was something gravelly in his voice at the last,
something that seemed to core her like a piece of ripe fruit.
"What would you say?" she asked.
He paused, his soul shifting ever so slightly.
"I would ask what you saw when you first touched my soul. I would want to know whether it was the same thing I saw."
She froze. Since finding herself in these strange lands, in her strange but delightful human form, she touched many souls, each with their own memories. She experienced life through many eyes, too many. When she'd touched Sir Dietrich's soul, it had been but a fleeting glimpse, and yet it was burned into her like a brand. A knife plunged into a man's heart. A boy crying, leaving his mother to become a soldier. Many fierce battles. Friendship. Those he killed. Those he lost. None more poignant than being surrounded by enemies, his allies falling one after another, each taking a piece of his heart with them. The will to die. The will to live. Growing purpose. An opportunity. Lost. Renewed hope in the form of a giant of a man, the one they called the Armored Knight. There was one other memory, too, but she pushed it away, for it didn't make sense.
"I saw your scars."
Dietrich frowned.
"Truly?
But your blindness, I don't know what physical scars you bear, but I see your scars all the same. Just not the ones the world sees."
She could sense his eyes were tethered to hers.
"And what do they look like?" he asked.
"Your best and worst memories," she said.
"All of them?"
She considered the question.
"I don't know."
Again, that last image sprang to mind, unbidden. It was her, standing atop that snowy cliff, moving through the throngs of Ghazi soldiers as they parted down the middle, her blue eye glowing. She'd never seen herself until she'd seen this image through Sir Dietrich's vision. Through his eyes, she saw a woman in control, a woman with an honorable purpose. She saw what she suspected was the best version of herself, not the harbinger of death and war she knew she was.
Was I the best or the worst of his memories?
"I'm sorry," she said.
"I know it was painful when I was inside your head."
He laughed, though she couldn't fathom what might be amusing.
"It was, but it was the best pain I've ever felt."
"You're mocking me," she said, but didn't really mind it.
"Yes, but I'm mocking you with the truth."
She tried to unknot the tangled threads of his words.
What was he saying, exactly? "You are peculiar."
"So I've been told, many times. But isn't that the pot calling the kettle?"
"Calling the kettle what? And in what land would a pot be able to speak?"
Dietrich laughed.
"Sorry, it's just a saying. It means you are peculiar, too."
She couldn't argue with that. Sometimes she felt like a different species entirely. Before she could respond, however, Dietrich asked,
"Do you ever wish you didn't bear your mark?"
The question surprised her. It would be like changing one's eye color or height. Her mark was simply a part of her, something undeniable, even if it made life harder sometimes. Well, most of the time. Then again, without it, the Ghazi likely would have killed her on that snowy hill in the hinterlands when she first arrived in these lands.
"Do you?"
she countered. "All the time," he said without hesitation.
"Why?"
"So I wouldn't have to feel guilty anymore."
"About what?"
"Not saving my father when I had the chance."
Pieces of a convoluted puzzle clicked together one by one. Seeing the best and worst images painted on a soul's canvas was like seeing half a picture. Now, however, the full scene came into view. The man who'd been stabbed in the heart was his father. Sir Dietrich was sword-marked. He could have saved him. Thus, the crying boy, leaving home, joining the army, fighting in countless battles, trying to atone for his failure as a son.
"I feel the same way," she said,
feeling more than hearing the truth in her words.
"I thought so," he said. "The sleeping knights. They saved Darin. They saved Terin.
You did the right thing.
Did she?
Yes, they'd helped repel the invaders. But if what she saw in the future came to pass, they would cause far more destruction than they would prevent. If they were truly the horde she kept seeing, the responsibility would fall on her shoulders alone.
I don't know, she said neutrally. Dietrich stood suddenly, his soul brightening. A portion of it moved closer to her. His hand, she realized.
Come, he said. I want to show you something. She took his hand, and he easily pulled her to her feet. His hand was warm in hers, and it took all her effort to hold back her eye, which pulsed rapidly, trying to slip into his soul.
Just a taste, it seemed to say. I must drink, or I shall become thirsty.
No, she thought back. She didn't want to hurt this man again. Life had hurt him enough as it was. He pulled her along at his side. Somewhere in the distance, she saw a flashing sea of red-black souls, the sleeping knights moving and shifting, anxious for daylight so they could move closer to the impending battle at Castle Hill. To the opposite side were hundreds of souls of various colours, most lying on the ground, sleeping. Others patrolled the area, keeping watch, slightly brighter than the rest. Sir Dietrich, however, moved away from them all, toward a group of tall, silvery souls, bearing many limbs.
Trees, she thought.
The largest soul of them all rose well above, springing from their midst, stretching toward the golden star souls, her friends in another life. Through the wood they went, weaving between the silvery spires. At some point along the way, Dietrich's fingers threaded with hers. When they stopped, her lips parted slightly. A soul as wide as 20 men, standing side by side with their arms extended, stood before her. It was 100 colours if it was one, silver and fuchsia and ivory, turquoise and lavender and gold, ebony, jade and scarlet, and countless others, stretching higher and higher into eternity, always moving, dancing amongst each other like bubbles in a fast-flowing river.
You see it, don't you? Sir Dietrich asked,
his grip tightening on her.
Yes, she said.
It's impossible to describe. Yes, I know. I've stared at this tree more times than I can remember. When I was lost, it was the landmark I always found. It reminds me that I am small, like it once was. It reminds me that even the smallest things, like a seed, can become a mighty tree one day.
Thank you, Lisbeth said.
For what?
For seeing more than just a blind girl who brings pain to all she touches.
You're welcome. And thank you.
For what?
For being the last best thing I've experienced in my life thus far.
7. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Next to her short hair, Queen Rhea Loren barely noticed her scarred face. And yet, seeing her golden locks hacked unevenly, no longer than shoulder length now, didn't bother her nearly as much as it once would have. After all, it was Rathoth's sharp beak that had lopped it off, the shimmering strands falling into its gaping maw while the crowd screamed, and Rhea considered whether testing her god was such a smart decision. In the end, it had been. Rathos, the ancient hundred-tentacled sea monster, had been satisfied with her hair. Her people had stared at her with a mixture of awe and fear that was intoxicating. Still, the message from Roth was clear. I can end you. Serve me or die. Thus far, the vengeful god had provided one more miracle, when her city, Night's End, the beacon of independence in the west, was on the verge of burning to ash by the strange and unnatural fire started when Empress Fire Sands, curse her name, perished while fighting the Phoenicians at the Southron Gates. The spring rains known as Roth's Tears had arrived just then, vanquishing the fires and sparing the city. Since those two events, The people of Night's End had flocked like sheep to the castle gates on a daily basis, wanting to hear Rhea's speeches, wanting to be close to her, to soak up the light that seemed to shine from her white purity gown, which bulged at her abdomen like a ripe melon. "Our child," she thought, her hand drifting subconsciously to her belly, as it often did. The growing baby inside kicked in response. "She's getting stronger by the day." In truth, it was Grey Iris's child, created during a night that started with passion and ended in fear and betrayal. But the people believed it to be Roth's offspring, which allowed Rhea to maintain her veil of purity and righteousness. If they knew the truth, the Furia would have no choice but to execute her in Roth's holy name. In front of her, the doors opened and light spilled through, chasing away the inky shadows. The crowd roared. Hundreds dropped to their knees, touching their chins to their palms. A sign of respect to their god, but it wasn't Roth who they faced. "It is me." Rhea choked back the thought, trying to humble herself. "I cannot be that selfish girl any more. I almost destroyed us. Yes, I saved my people in the Bay of Bounty, but it was my own arrogance that caused Bee's death." A bitter stew of revulsion and self-hate swirled bitterly in her stomach. She swallowed it back. Bee was gone. Though she and her sister had grown apart over the last several years, their animosity boiling over the pot of their relationship, she hadn't wanted her dead. Roth had taken her anyway, and Rhea knew what it was, a reminder.
"You are my servant. I can break you and everything and everyone close to you if I choose."
"I will remember,"
Rhea whispered to herself, lifting a hand to the sky. The rains had abated, but a spring mist continued to fall, leaving the entire city glistening like a bed of flowers on a dewy morning. She closed her eyes and soaked it in.
"What is your command?"
she prayed. It still felt odd, praying. Though she'd acted in Roth's name since her coronation, it had been false. Now, however, she knew that whatever happened next would be her god's will, and not hers. Roth didn't answer in words, but in feeling, dumping adrenaline into her bloodstream, gathering strength in her arms and legs, lifting her weariness.
It was time for war.
"That went well,"
her fury said, falling into step, not beside her, but a pace back. Rhea had hand-picked her three furies, and they shadowed her steps like obedient dogs when they weren't out in the city maintaining order and righteousness. This one in particular never strayed far. Rhea glanced back, saw the way the sharp angles of the woman's face tightened slightly, how her lips pursed.
"She fears me still. Good. Let her obey out of fear, so long as she obeys."
"Yes,"
she said lightly, facing forward once more.
"The size of our army tripled from one speech. Any word from the Furium?"
The Furium was the home of the Furia, a nondescript structure in the midst of Night's End, where girls were turned into warriors, devout servants of Roth. Which was much the same as saying servants of the Queen, her own personal army. Rhea still remembered watching two young girls do battle with staffs, bloodying each other again and again, but never faltering, never failing to get back up for another round.
"Young girls are flocking to its gates. It will take a week to process them all and begin their training."
Rhea stopped, and the fury stopped just as fast, as if she'd been anticipating it.
"Not good enough,"
Rhea said, letting the edge of a sword infiltrate her tone.
"Process them all today. Begin their training tomorrow. Accelerate it. Even if we defeat Vaynes, Calypso's counter will be swift. We have to be ready."
"Yes, Your Highness,"
the Fury answered. She didn't bow, but Rhea could tell she had the urge to.
"You may go."
Rhea turned away and marched on, shadowed by a dozen guardsmen. For a moment she forgot herself, allowing her eyes to scan their lines for her cousin, Ennis Loren, whose death she had faked, disguising him as one of the guards. She shook her head, pushing away the feelings of aloneness that often plagued her. Grey was gone. Ennis, too. She'd pushed them away. No, shoved them. And B. Taking a deep breath, she walked on, toward the Royal Stream. She entered through a low archway, picking up her dress as she clambered down to the water's edge. Two stream workers pretended not to stiffen at her approach.
"There is fear everywhere I go. Am I such a monster?"
She didn't answer herself, hating the truth.
"There is a time to atone. I will atone."
She'd done so before, after all. First, she'd defeated the Northerners in the bay. And then she'd saved both the East and West when she'd killed Darkspell and foiled his plans to release a contagion into the waters of the Spear. But could such magnanimous acts of good wash away the stench of blood on her hands? She had to believe it could. Roth wanted her to go south, where the heathens kept slaves. Yes, there was word of a faction fighting against the Hosa Empire, but as far as she knew, Falcon Hosa was still alive. And as long as a Hosa maintained power, there would be slavery. So she would go south, riding with her army. For once, her personal desires were aligned with those of the kingdom.
Ennis is south, somewhere. Please be alive. Please, oh please, oh Highness?
She blinked. One of the stream workers, a young maiden about her own age, looked at her with doe eyes and held a dry scroll tied with a ribbon in one hand. In the other hand, she held another piece of parchment, dripping wet. She waved it lightly back and forth.
"Yes, thank you."
She reached out to retrieve the dry sheet first, deftly untying it, unspooling the paper, holding her breath. It was from her cousin, Queen Anise Garrick, in the north. A request for aid, the second such she'd received this week. She released her breath with a huff. Alliances could be so frustrating. Instead of marching south into battle with her cousin, as she'd imagined, she was being asked to split her forces into two. In the long term, it might pay off, but who knew how many soldiers she would lose trying to help her niece reclaim Castle Hill from the sellswords?
"Would you like me to respond?"
the stream worker asked. Rhea considered.
"Yes. Ask the Queen to abandon Castle Hill and march south immediately. If she helps us defeat Fanes, we will reciprocate. Bring me the draft letter, and I'll review it." "Yes, Your Highness."
The other message, the fresh, damp one, dangled from her fingertips. Rhea took it, not caring that it dripped down her dress as she scanned it. It was from the East.
"Yes. Oh, yes."
Gareth Ironclad was now the king, his brother Gryon dead from a surprise attack by the Calypsians and their dragons.
"Roth works in mysterious ways," Rhea thought.
King Gareth Ironclad, once her prisoner, was now her ally. For the first time in more than a century, there would be peace between the East and West. The Easterners would march on the Southron gates. 8. The Eastern Kingdom, Feria. Gareth Ironclad. It was done. The unthinkable. An alliance with the West. "Father is rolling over in his frozen grave," Gareth thought. Gryon, too. Guy, even in death, would support his decision, as would his mother. "But they are not alive, not one of them. I am alone. Even Roan has abandoned me. And Gwendolyn, oh, awe, when she finds out what I've..." The door to the courtroom slammed open to reveal Gwendolyn Storm, the sleek, slender angles of her armoured form pulled taut like a bowstring. She looked ready for a fight, which was about the norm for the fiery woman. Several legionnaires rushed in behind her, shouting protests, but she sprang away from them, cat-like. "No," Gareth thought. "She is far faster than a cat. More like the wind, uncatchable." Then again, she did bear the hero mark. She stood directly in front of him, the anger seeming to rise from her in waves. Even like this, she was beautiful, Gareth mused. No wonder Roan can't resist her.
Your Highness, I'm sorry, we tried to stop.
Gareth waved his hand.
It's fine. Leave us.
The legionnaires, looking relieved, hurried away as quickly as they'd arrived.
You,
Gwen said, stalking forward. After the speed and agility she'd demonstrated, the pace felt like slow motion now.
Me,
Gareth said.
Yes. That about sums things up, doesn't it?
Gwen wasn't amused.
The Calypsians attacked us with dragons. They killed your brother. Hundreds perished. Where was the West when we needed them? Have you forgotten so quickly?
Gareth knew she could kill him in less than the time it would take him to shake his head. But he also knew she wouldn't. Not after everything she'd gone through to restore him to the Eastern Throne. Plus, they were supposed to be friends, even if he felt like mud under her tread at times.
I have not forgotten.
Then why ally yourself with them in a war we care nothing about?
Beyond the anger, there was a note of pleading in her voice now. She truly didn't understand. Sometimes the past obscured the present, creating a future that was no better for drinking than a pool of muddy water. Gareth knew he needed to tread lightly. The Orion had been through so much already, nearly 90 years of tragedy and pain.
We defeated the Calypsians. We killed the Dragon Masters. We, not all of them,
Gwen growled. Gareth still remembered how Empress Raven Sands had saved him. He also remembered how Bane had touched her and they'd both vanished. As far as he was concerned, she was dead, though he wasn't certain yet how to feel about that fact.
We killed their dragons, he continued.
Not all of them,
Gwen said again, taking another step forward. Gareth grimaced. It was true. They'd managed to capture one of the dragons, the one Raven Sands herself had ridden into battle. The same winged creature that had killed his brother while he'd watched helplessly.
The dragon is a valuable prisoner.
It's a monster.
Can't it be both?
What will you do with it?
I don't know yet. Anyway, I thought you wanted peace with the West. It's what Roan would have wanted.
Dropping Roan's name was unfair, and Gareth instantly regretted it.
I do want peace, you fool.
Only Gwen was bold enough to call the king a fool. Secretly, Gareth preferred such honesty. Pedestals were for statues of the dead, not the flesh and blood of the living.
And don't pretend like Roan is yours alone. I care for him, too.
There was silence for a brief moment. It felt like something was breaking, slowly cracking into two pieces. Then Gwen said,
I won't ride with you against the Phoenicians.
It was a truth Gareth had known even as he'd penned the treaty contract with Rhea Loran and the West. This truth was what had made streaming the letter so difficult.
I know.
She nodded, but said nothing more.
What will you do?
Gareth asked.
Do you truly want to know?
Gareth shook his head, debating whether to tell her the other news.
Truth, he thought. It is the only way forward.
Viper Sands has claimed the Calypsian throne.
What?
As if by instinct, Gwen's hand curled over her shoulder, resting on her bow.
She has no claim on the throne, not unless Whisper and Raven are dead. Last I heard, Viper was in Kesh, managing the fighting pits.
Gareth nodded.
That's what everyone thought.
But something has changed.
A coup?
I don't know yet. The stream arrived not an hour ago. She requested a negotiation.
Gwen's grip on her bow tightened, until her knuckles were fully white.
A negotiation for what?
Peace,
Gareth said, the word sounding unfamiliar, as if spoken in a foreign tongue.
Have you responded?
He shook his head slowly.
What will you say?
The question felt like an arrow zipping for his head.
I haven't decided yet, but I am leaning toward agreeing if the Calypsians are willing to make restitutions for the damage caused during the dragon defense.
And if you return their dragon?
Gwen spat. Not a question.
They murdered your people. It was a battle. Soldiers will always die in a battle. They attacked our capital. Viper Sands had nothing to do with that. Raven did, and you let her escape. Anyway, they are all the same. The Sands are snakes, all of them. Watch yourself, lest they bite you. Their poison is deadly. With that, she turned and left. Gareth wished it didn't hurt so much to see her go.
9. The Eastern Kingdom, Feria. Gwendolyn Storm. Though Gwendolyn Storm had accused the Sands of being snakes, she could feel her own serpent uncoiling in her stomach, breathing fire through her body. Anger made people dumb. She breathed slowly, tempering her rage. But it was still there, hot coals releasing dark smoke. Forgiveness had never come easy to her, especially when it involved the Calypsians. And I won't forgive now. Someone must hold them accountable. As she approached the large circular iron structure, a lifetime of memories was unspooled. Fire, ash, screams rending the air, a cacophony of fear and pain, drowned out by the roar of dragons, the beating of leather wings and the clanks of steel on steel. Running, outpacing the wind itself, challenging the speed of the rays of sunlight spilling through the trees. Firing arrow after arrow into the enemy ranks, sometimes two at a time, sometimes three, never missing her mark. Watching the love of her life die. His perfect words the only thing left of him, etched into her heart like another failed mark of power. Moving forward in time. Her father's lifeless body strapped to a tree, slowly covered by ore channeled by his people, until he was gone, becoming one with the forest he loved, Ironwood. His home. His final resting place. Another casualty in the war with Calypso. Another brick in her pillar of revenge. Moving forward once more. Countless battles, countless dead. Finally, finally, killing that enormous grey dragon, slicing it open from belly to throat, spilling its fire and life before her. Defeating its cold-eyed master as easily as stepping on a worm after a spring rain. Victory was hers. Revenge, too. They'd won. The dragons, save one, were dead. The Sands fighting amongst themselves. A roar snapped her back to the present, a final thought vanishing like rising smoke. Then why am I not satisfied? Why am I not happy? The guard stepped aside as she strode inside the structure. Another roar shook the walls. The red-backed dragon was royally pissed off. Its head swung from side to side, smashing into the iron walls. With each ram, it sent a blast of flames into the sides of the prison. The heat was enough to melt the ore, but its tethers, long, heavy chains attached to each foot, each claw, and its neck, were sufficient to prevent it from breaking through the stone wall sandwiched between two thick layers of iron. Dragon-proof, the original Orion designer had called it, all those years ago, when the structure had originally been built. For decades it had stood empty, used occasionally for large gatherings. Eventually the woman responsible for its creation passed on, following Gwen's father into the great forest of Orion. Gwen stood on a viewing platform, high above the upper limits of the dragon's reach. There were dozens of other Orions and humans, pointing and gawking at the display of raw aggression far below. By dragon standards, Gwen figured the massive beast was slight, perhaps the smallest of all those that had attacked the Iron Keep not a fortnight ago. The black monster she had slain might have been twice the size. Yet, this was the one that survived, she thought, observing it more carefully. Watching the powerful beast maneuver from side to side, back to front, swinging its spiked tail at the walls of its prison, Gwen wondered whether there truly was such a thing as dragon-proof. It's testing the walls, she thought, noticing how it never struck the same point twice. Its seemingly random tantrum has logic, purpose. It can think. Somehow the thought unsettled her. Gwen preferred thinking of dragons as senseless killing machines. In between its assault on the walls, The dragon shot thin gouts of flame at its chains, melting the links to free up one portion of its body. Then it would swivel toward another chain, attempting to melt it before the prior chain could be reformed by the dozens of Orion channelers positioned out of reach on other platforms. They worked in shifts night and day, an entire squad of them for just this one dragon. Each time, the dragon failed. Each time, it also seemed to get a hair faster, as if learning from its previous mistakes. Wading through the crowd, Gwen reached the end of the platform, placing her palms on the edge of the waist-high iron wall. Abruptly, the dragon froze. Next to the cacophony of a moment earlier, the silence felt absolute. Collectively, the spectators seemed to hold their breaths, as if afraid to shatter the quiet. The dragon sniffed the air, steam wafting from its black nostrils. It looked up, and its eyes met Gwen's. Ciri.
Death, pain, hate, fire, ash, blood, fear, rage. Dragon killer.
It was the last that stopped Ciri in her tracks. Rare were two leggers who had slain a dragon. Rarer still were those left unchanged by the experience. Ciri could smell both on this woman, the death, the ash, the dragon blood. And yet her lifeline was unchanged, a consistent path of emotion that was as steady over the last decade as the sun's daily jaunt from horizon to horizon. Before that, there was chaos, fear, pain, deaths of those she loved. Sadness, as complete as the times when the moons blocked the light of the sun. An eclipse, Ciri thought, remembering the two-legger term for it. And hate. So much hate that it seemed to roil from her in waves. This two-legger wished her dead. Would kill her herself if she had the opportunity.
You do not understand, she thought. You will.
And then she launched herself at the platform. Gwendolyn. The attack was so swift that for a moment no one reacted, watching as the dragon bent its knees and then exploded upward, simultaneously twisting its neck from side to side to melt the chains securing its ankles before the channelers could so much as blink. Leathery wings that had been tucked against the dragon's spiky red back burst outward, churning the stale air into a frenzy. Streams of flame shot for the platform, which was supposedly out of the range of dragonfire, but which now seemed so close as the beast extended its reach. Gwen leapt into action, spinning and shoving the other spectators back while shouting, "Run!" A mad scramble ensued, bodies tumbling over bodies, arms tangling with legs, people trying to leap over the fallen in their haste to escape, others crawling on elbows and knees, diving through the entrance. Red, orange, yellow, flames all around, licking over the sides of the platform, which should have been made of stone. Why isn't it made of stone? Gwen could feel the heat through the steel soles of her boots as the floor began to melt away. She sprang to the side without thinking, the X-shaped hero mark on her cheek blooming with a fire of its own, sending strength to her muscles, speed to her arms and legs. Even as she flew through the air, she thought, there are still people on the platform, and threw her hands back over her head while simultaneously clamping her knees over the side wall, which, mercifully, was untouched by the flames and still attached to the structure. She grabbed two different hands, one with each of her own, watching with horror as two other people she couldn't reach fell, their eyes wide, their mouths open in silent screams. Gwen couldn't think about them now, had to focus on swinging once, twice, gaining momentum, and throwing the two she held through the arched doorway. The wall melted, hot liquid ore burning through her iron gloves, even as she refortified them by channeling ore from other parts of her armor. Her backswing had launched her away from the melting platform, and now she reached for the structure's wall, channeling the ore into a handhold the moment her fingers brushed it. She hung precariously for a second, adding footholds to secure her new position. When she looked back, the dragon was there, hovering before her, its wings undulating slowly, broad, graceful strokes, its eyes fathomless black pits filled with golden stars. It eyed her with something between mild interest and vague hunger. What she saw in its eyes surprised her.
No, she thought. Not it. Her. This dragon is a female.
And what she saw was grudging respect. Ciri.
One blast of fire and she could destroy this two-legger, this forest dweller, the enemy. They keep you in chains. They take away your flight. They hate you. They despise your kind. She killed Dragon Cronus. I can smell his stink, his treason. This two-legger killed the traitor who killed Dragon Heyron, kind, gentle Heyron. Cronus attacked his own kind, murdered Heyron and Dragon Master Ryder, who rubbed your belly and fed you and helped make you more than you would have been. And this two-legger saved two of her own, risking her own life while others fled. Strangely, this two-legger reminded Ciri of another two-legger, her two-legger, Raven. The thought seemed to shred her chest and pull fiery breath from her lungs.
Where is she? Where is she? Is she safe? Is she well? Is she hurt? Is she coming for me? Can't let her come for me. Must protect her.
The bite of chains reattaching to her legs snapped her back from her thoughts, even as she was yanked backwards by a force stronger than that of her wings. She crashed to the ground, the momentum of her sudden fall dragging her back, toppling her. She rolled over, hating this feeling of helplessness, this feeling of imprisonment, the sky like an impossible place, unreachable if she had eons to achieve it. The woman, still clinging to the wall, was watching her, a frown creasing her face. It was confusion. It was calculating. Her smell changed. Dragon killer, yes, but something else, too. Her lifeline wobbled just the tiniest bit before resuming its consistent path across time.
Find her. Find my soul, Ciri thought.
Gwendolyn. The entire experience had unnerved her. Though it had been only a few seconds, the way the dragon's eyes had bored into her had left a mark. Why didn't she strike? Gwen knew the dragon had had ample time to slash a claw at her, or breathe flames, or do something other than stare at her. And yet, she hadn't. Why? The question seemed to pull at her mind, making it impossible to sleep. No, she thought. It was something else driving her insomnia. She felt cold, not from the temperature, which was mild, but inside, like her guts had been packed with snow. The feeling was such a contrast to the typical fire inside her at the thought of anything related to the Calypsians or their awe-forsaken dragons that sleep continued to elude her. She knew she should hate the dragon for killing another two of her people, the two spectators that had fallen to their deaths, but she couldn't. Even knowing it was this dragon who had killed Gareth's brother, Gryon, didn't stoke the coals of her vengeance. Instead, she felt nothing but sorrow for the dragon, confined to a prison, her wings useless, her powerful legs controlled by iron manacles. What is wrong with me? Gwen thought, sitting up in her hammock, high in the iron tree she called home. The movement caused her to swing gently from side to side. This is wrong, she muttered. The alliance with the West, the planned attack on Fanes, everything. It wasn't the dragon causing her inner strife, but Gareth Ironclad's deal with Rhea Loren. Yes, that has to be it. Gwen was simply getting her own mind confused. She knew she wouldn't sleep well until someone had been punished for the attack on Feria. And that someone was Raven Sands.
Find her. Find my soul.
She remembered the way the dragon's thoughts had appeared in her own mind.
I will find your soul, she thought, and I will kill her.
10. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Zelda Garrick. Something was happening. Zelda rolled over and placed her ear against the hard stone floor. Vibrations rumbled through the surface, sometimes closer, sometimes farther, but consistent.
It's time, she thought.
Lending credence to her thoughts, shouts echoed down the stairwell. It had only been 2 days since she'd gained access to the mammoth and herd, but she'd already more than convinced the Brotherhood that she'd trained the beasts to follow their orders. What they didn't know was that the training was temporary and could be superseded.